Chapter 33. A New Weave in the Pattern. The Lord himself followed almost on the boy's heels, a tall, broad-shouldered man in his middle years, with a hard, angular face and dark reddish hair, white-winged at the temples. There was an arrogant cast to his dark blue eyes, and he certainly looked every inch a nobleman, in a finely cut green coat discreetly embroidered in golden scrolls down the sleeves, and gauntlets worked in thread of gold. Gold work wrapped his sword scabbard as well, and the banded tops of his polished boots. Somehow he made the simple act of striding in through the doorway grand. Perrin despised him on sight. All the Alcines and Luans rushed in a mass to greet the Lord, men, women, and children crowding around him with smiles and bows and curtsies, babbling all over one another about the honor of his presence, the great honor of a visit from a hunter for the horn. They seemed most excited about that. A lord under the same roof might be exciting, but one of those sworn to search for the legendary Horn of Valir, that was the stuff of stories. Perrin did not think he had ever seen Two Rivers folk fawn over anybody, but these came close. This Lord Luke took it as clearly no more than his due, perhaps less, and tiresome to put up with at that. The farm folk did not seem to see, or maybe they just did not recognize that slightly weary expression, the slightly condescending smile. Maybe they simply thought that was how lords behaved. True enough, a good many did, but it irked Perrin to watch these people, his people, put up with it. As the hubbub began to diminish, Jack and Eliza presented their other guests, all but Tam and Abel, who had already met him, to Lord Luke of Chindelna, saying that he was advising them in ways to defend themselves against the Trollocs, that he encouraged them to stand up to the White Cloaks, stand up for themselves. Approving murmurs of agreement came from the rest of the room. If the Two Rivers had been choosing a king, Lord Luke would have had the Alcines and Luans behind him entire. He knew it, too. His apparent bored complacency did not last long, though. At his first glimpse of Varen's smooth-cheeked face, Luke stiffened slightly, eyes flickering to her hands so quickly many would not have noticed. He very nearly dropped his embroidered gloves. Plump and plainly dressed, she might have been another farm wife, but clearly he knew an Aes Sedai's ageless face when he saw one. He was not particularly happy to see one here. The corner of his left eye twitched as he listened to Mistress Alcine name Mistress Mathwin, a scholar from outside. Varen smiled at him as if half asleep.
"A pleasure," she murmured. "House Chindelna. Where is that? It has a borderland sound."
"Not so grand," Luke replied quickly, giving her a wary fractional bow. "Murindy, actually. A minor house, but old."
He seemed uneasy about taking his eyes from her for the rest of the introductions. Tomas he barely glanced at. He had to know him for Mistress Mathwin's warder, yet dismissed him out of hand as clearly as if he had shouted it. That was purely strange. However good Luke was with that sword, no one was good enough to dismiss a warder. Arrogance. The fellow had enough for 10 men. He proved it with Fahil so far as Perrin was concerned. The smile Luke offered her was certainly more than self-assured. It was also familiar and decidedly warm. In fact, it was too admiring and too warm by half. He took her hand in both of his to bow over and peered into her eyes as if trying to see through the back of her head. For an instant, Perrin thought she was about to look over at him, but instead she returned the Lord's stare with a red-cheeked pretense to coolness and a slight bow of her head.
"I, too, am a hunter of the horn, my lord," she said, sounding a touch breathless. "Do you think to find it here?"
Luke blinked and released her hand.
"Perhaps, my lady. Who can say where the horn might be?"
Fahil looked a little surprised, maybe disappointed, at his sudden loss of interest. Perrin kept his expression neutral. If she wanted to smile at Will Alcine and blush at Fool Lord, she could. She could make an idiot of herself any way she wanted, gawking at every man who came along. So Luke wanted to know where the Horn of Valir was. It was hidden away in the White Tower, that was where.
He was tempted to tell the man, just to make him grind his teeth in frustration. If Luke had been surprised to find out who his other fellows in the All-Seen House were, his reaction to Perrin was peculiar, to say the least. He gave a start at the sight of Perrin's face. Shock flashed in his eyes. It was all gone in a moment, masked behind lordly haughtiness, except for a wild fluttering at the corner of one eye. The trouble was, it made no sense. It was not his yellow eyes that took Luke aback, he was sure of that. More as if the fellow knew him somehow, and was surprised to see him here. But he had never met this Luke before in his life. More than that, he would have bet that Luke was afraid of him. No sense at all.
"Lord Luke is the one who suggested the boys go up on the rooftops," Jack said. "No Trolloc will get close without those lads giving warning."
"How much warning?" Perrin said dryly.
This was an example of the great Lord Luke's advice.
"Trollocs see like cats in the dark. They'll be on top of you, kicking in the doors before your boys raise a shout."
"We do what we can," Flan barked. "Stop trying to frighten us. There are children listening. Lord Luke at least offers helpful suggestions. He was at my place the day before the Trollocs came, seeing I had everybody placed properly. Blood and ashes! If not for him, the Trollocs would have killed us all."
Luke did not seem to hear the praise offered him. He was watching Perrin cautiously while fussing with his gauntlets, tucking them behind the golden wolf's head buckle of his sword belt. Fael was watching him, too, with a slight frown. He ignored her.
"I thought it was White Cloak saved you, Master Lewin. I thought a White Cloak patrol arrived in the nick of time and drove the Trollocs off."
"Well, they did."
Flan scrubbed a hand through his gray hair.
"But Lord Luke, if the White Cloaks hadn't come, we could have... At least he doesn't try to frighten us," he muttered.
"So he doesn't frighten you," Perrin said. "Trollocs frighten me, and the White Cloaks keep the Trollocs back for you, when they can."
"You want to credit the White Cloaks?"
Luke fixed Perrin with a cold stare, as if pouncing on a weakness.
"Who do you think is responsible for the dragon's fang scribbled on people's doors? Oh, their hands never hold charcoal, but they're behind it. They stalk into these good people's homes, asking questions and demanding answers, as if it were their own roof overhead. I say these people are their own masters, not dogs for White Cloaks to call to heel. Let them patrol the countryside, well and good. But meet them at the door and tell them whose land they are on. That is what I say. If you want to be a White Cloak dog, be so. But do not begrudge these good people their freedom."
Perrin met Luke's eyes, stare for stare. "I hold no affection for White Cloaks. They want to hang me, or hadn't you heard?"
The tall lord blinked as though he had not, or maybe had forgotten in his eagerness to spring.
"Exactly what is it you do propose, then?"
Perrin turned his back on the man and went to stand in front of the fireplace. He did not mean to argue with Luke. Let everyone listen. They were certainly all looking at him. He would say what he thought and be done with it.
"You have to depend on the White Cloaks. Have to hope they'll keep the Trollocs down. Hope they'll come in time if the Trollocs attack."
"Why?"
"Because every man tries to hang on to his farm, if he can, or to stay as close to it as possible if he can't. You're in 100 little clusters like grapes ripe for picking. As long as you are, as long as you have to pray the White Cloaks can keep the Trollocs from stomping you into wine, you've no choice but to let them ask any question they want, demand any answers they want. You have to stand by and watch innocent people hauled off. Or does anyone here think Harl and Alsbet Luhon are dark friends? Natty Cawthon? Bodwin and Eldrin?"
Abel's stare around the room dared anyone to hint at a yes, but there was no need. Even Adina Lewin's attention was on Perrin. Luke frowned at him between studying the reactions of the people crowding the room.
"I know they shouldn't have arrested Natty and all's bet and all," Witt said, "but that's over."
He rubbed a hand across his bald head and gave Abel a troubled look.
"Except for getting them to let everybody go, I mean. They haven't arrested anyone since, that I've heard."
"You think that means it's done?" Perrin said. "Do you really think they'll be satisfied with the Cawthons and the Luhans? With two farms burned? Which of you will be next? Maybe because you said the wrong thing or just to make an example? It could be White Cloaks putting a torch to this house instead of Trollocs. Or maybe it'll be the dragon's fang scrawled on your door some night. There are always folk who believe that kind of thing."
A number of eyes darted to Adina, who shifted her feet and hunched her shoulders.
"Even if all it means is having to tug your forelock to every White Cloak who comes along, do you want to live that way? Your children. You're at the mercy of the Trollocs, the mercy of the White Cloaks, and the mercy of anybody with a grudge. As long as one has a hold on you, all three do. You're hiding in the cellar, hoping one rabid dog will protect you from another, hoping the rats don't sneak out in the dark and bite you."
Jack exchanged worried looks with Flan and Witt, with the other men in the room, then said slowly,
"If you think we're doing wrong, what is it you suggest?"
Perrin was not expecting the question. He had been sure they would get angry. But he went right on telling them what he thought.
"Gather your people. Gather your sheep and your cows, your chickens, everything. Gather them up and take them where they might be safe. Go to Emmons Field, or Watch Hill since it's closer, though that will put you right under the White Cloak's eyes. As long as it's 20 people here and 50 there, you are game for Trolloc taking. If there are hundreds of you together, you have a chance, and one that doesn't depend on bowing your necks for the White Cloaks."
That brought the explosion he expected.
"Abandon my farm completely!" Flan shouted right on top of Witt's. "You're mad!"
Words poured out on top of one another from them and from brothers and cousins.
"Go off to Emmons Field. I'm too far away to do more than check the fields every day right now. The weeds will take everything. I don't know how I'm going to harvest as it is. If the rains come, trying to rebuild, tobacco will rot. Have to leave the clip."
Perrin's fist smacking the lintel of the fireplace cut them short.
"I haven't seen a field trampled or fired or a house or barn burned unless there were people there. It's people the Trollocs come for. And if they burn it anyway, a new crop can be planted. Stone and mortar and wood can be rebuilt. Can you rebuild that?"
He pointed at Lila's baby, and she clutched the child to her breast, glaring at him as though he had threatened the babe himself. The looks she gave her husband and Flan were frightened, though. An uneasy murmur rose.
"Leave," Jack muttered, shaking his head. "I don't know, Perrin." "It is your choice, Master Alcine. The land will still be here when you come back. Trollocs can't carry that off. Think whether the same can be said for your family."
The murmur grew to a buzz. A number of women were confronting their husbands, mostly those with a child or two in tow. None of the men seemed to be arguing.
"An interesting plan," Luke said, studying Perrin.
From his face, there was no telling whether he approved of it.
"I shall watch to see how it turns out. And now, Master Alcine, I must be on my way. I only stopped to see how you were doing."
Jack and Eliza saw him to the door, but the others were too busy with their own discussions to pay much attention. Luke left tight-mouthed. Perrin had the feeling his departures were usually as grand as his arrivals.
Jack came from the door to Perrin.
"It's a bold plan you have. I will admit I'm not keen on abandoning my farm, but you talk sense. I don't know what the children will make of it, though. They seem a suspicious lot to me. They might think we're all plotting something against them if we gather together."
"Let them think it," Perrin said. "A village full of people can take Luke's advice and tell them to be about their business elsewhere."
Or do you think it's better to stay vulnerable just to hold the White Cloak's goodwill, such as it is?
No. No, I see your point. You've convinced me. And everybody else, too, it seems.
It did appear to be true. The murmur of discussion was dying down, but only because everyone looked to be in agreement. Even Adina, who was marshaling her daughters with loud orders for packing immediately. She actually gave Perrin a grudgingly approving nod.
"When do you mean to go?" Perrin asked Jack.
"As soon as I can get everybody ready. We can make John Galen's place on the North Road before sunset. I'll tell John what you say, and everybody down Demon's Field. Better there than Watch Hill. If we mean to be out from under the White Cloak's thumb, as well as the Trollocs, best not to sit under their noses."
Jack scratched his narrow fringe of hair with one finger.
"Perrin, I don't think the children would actually hurt Natty Cawthon and the girls, or the Luhans. But it worries me. If they do think we're plotting, who's to say?
I mean to get them free as soon as I can, Master Alcyon, and anybody else the White Cloaks arrest, for that matter."
"A bold plan," Jack repeated. "Well, I had better get people moving, if I'm going to have us to John's by sundown. Go with the light, Perrin."
"A very bold plan," Varen said, coming up as Master Alcyon hurried off, calling orders for wagons to be hauled out and people to pack what they could carry.
She studied Perrin interestedly, head tilted to one side, but no less so than Fael at her side. Fael looked as though she had never seen him before.
"I don't know why everybody keeps calling it that," he said. "A plan, I mean. That Luke was talking nonsense, defying White Cloaks in the door. Boys on the roof to watch for Trollocs. A couple of open gates to disaster. All I did was point it out. They should have been doing this from the start. That man..."
He stopped himself from saying Luke irritated him. Not with Fael there. She might misunderstand.
"Of course," Varen said smoothly. "I have not had the opportunity to see it work before this. Or perhaps I have and did not know it."
"What are you talking about? See what work?"
"Perrin, when we arrived, these people were ready to hold on here at all costs. You gave them good sense and strong emotion, but do you think the same from me would have shifted them, or from Tam or Abel? Of any of us, you should know how stubborn Two Rivers people can be. You have altered the course events would have followed in the Two Rivers without you. With a few words spoken in irritation? Taviren truly do pull other people's lives into their own pattern. Fascinating. I do hope I have an opportunity to observe Rand again."
"Whatever it is," Perrin muttered, "it's to the good. The more people together in one place, the safer."
"Of course. Rand does have the sword, I take it?"
He frowned, but there was no reason not to tell her. She knew about Rand, and she knew what Tyr had to mean.
"He does."
"Watch yourself with Alana, Perrin."
"What?"
The Aes Sedai's quick changes of topic were beginning to confuse him, especially when she started telling him to do what he had already thought of and thought to keep secret from her.
"Why?"
Varen's face did not change, but her dark eyes were suddenly bird-bright and sharp.
"There are many designs in the White Tower. Not all are malignant by far, but sometimes it is difficult to say until it is too late, and even the most benevolent often allow for a few threads snapped in the weaving, a few reeds broken and discarded in making a basket. A Taviren would make a useful reed in any number of possible plans."
Just as suddenly, she was looking a little confused by the bustle around her, more at home in a book or her own thoughts than in the real world.
"Oh, my. Master Alcyon is not wasting any time, is he? I'll just see if he can spare someone to fetch our horses."
Fael shivered as the brown sister moved away.
"Sometimes Aes Sedai make me Uneasy, she murmured.
Uneasy, Perrin said. Most of the time they scare me half to death.
She laughed softly and began playing with a button on his coat, peering at it intently.
Perrin, I have been a fool.
What do you mean? She glanced up at him. She was about to twist the button right off, and he hastily added, You are one of the least foolish people I know.
He clamped his teeth shut before he could add, most of the time, and was glad he had when she smiled.
That is very nice of you to say, but I was.
She patted the coat button and began adjusting his coat, which it did not need, and smoothing his lapels, which they did not need.
You are so silly, she said, speaking too fast, just because that young man looked at me. Really, he is much too boyish, not at all like you, that I thought I would make you jealous just a little by pretending to be attracted to Lord Luke. I should not have done it. Will you forgive me?
He tried to sort through the jumbled words. It was good she thought Will was boyish. If he tried to grow a beard, it would probably be straggly. But she had not mentioned the way she had returned Will's look. And if she had been pretending to be attracted to Luke, why had she blushed that way?
Of course I forgive you, he said. A dangerous light appeared in her eyes. I mean, there's nothing to forgive.
If anything, the light sparkled hotter. What did she want him to say?
Will you forgive me? When I was trying to chase you away, I said some things I shouldn't have. Will you forgive me that?
You said some things that need forgiving, she said sweetly.
And he knew he was in trouble.
I cannot think what, but I will take it into consideration.
Into consideration? She sounded very much the noblewoman there. Maybe her father worked for some lord, so she could study the way ladies talked. He had no idea what she meant. Whenever he found out would be too soon, he was certain. It was a relief to climb back into Stepper's saddle amid the confusion of wagon teams being hitched and people arguing over what they could or could not take and children chasing down chickens and geese and tying their feet for loading. Boys were already driving the cattle eastward and others herding the sheep out of the cote. Fail made no reference to what had been said inside. Indeed, she smiled at him and compared the keeping of sheep here to in Saldea. And when one of the girls brought her a bunch of small red flowers, heart's blush, she tried to thread some of them into his beard, laughing at his efforts to stop her. In short, she had him jumping out of his skin. He needed another talk with Master Cawthon.
Go at the light, Master Alcine told him again, just as they were ready to ride out, and look after the boys.
Four of the young men had decided to go with them, on rough-coated horses not nearly as good as those Tam and Abel rode. Perrin was not sure why he was the one who was supposed to look after them. They were all older than he, if not by much. Will Alcine was one, with his cousin Ban, one of Jack's sons, who had gotten all the nose in that family, and a pair of the Lewins, Tell and Danil, who looked so much like Flan that they could have been his sons instead of his nephews. Perrin had tried to talk them out of it, especially when they all made it plain that they wanted to help rescue the Cawthons and the Luhans from the White Cloaks. They seemed to think it was a matter of riding into the children's camp and demanding everybody's return. Casting down our defiance, Tell called it, which nearly made Perrin's hair stand on end. Too many gleeman's tales, too much listening to fools like Luke. He suspected that Will had another reason, though he tried to pretend Fael did not exist, but the others were bad enough. No one else made any objections. Tam and Abel only seemed concerned that they all knew how to use the bows they carried and could stay on a horse, and Varen merely observed, making notes in her little book. Tomas looked amused, and Fael busied herself plaiting a crown from the heart's blush, which turned out to be for Perrin. Sighing, he draped the flowers across the pommel of his saddle.
I will take care of them the best I can, Master Alcine, he promised.
A mile from the Alcine farm, he thought he might lose one or two right there, when Gaul and Bane and Chiad suddenly appeared out of a thicket, loping to join them. Lose them to Aiel's spears.
Will and his friends took one look at the Aiel and hastily began knocking arrows. Without breaking stride, the Aiel had spears ready to cast and their faces veiled. It took some minutes to straighten out. Gaul and the two maidens seemed to think it a huge joke when they understood, laughing uproariously. And that unsettled the Luans and Alcines as much as finding out that the three were Aiel, and two of them women. Will essayed a smile at Bane and Chiat, and they exchanged looks and brief nods. Perrin did not know what was going on there, but he decided to let it alone unless Will looked to get his throat cut. Time enough to stop it if one of the Aiel women actually took her knife out. Might teach Will a thing or two about smiling. He intended that they should push on to Watch Hill as quickly as they could, but a mile or so north of the All-Seen place, he saw one of the farms that produced those scattered plumes of chimney smoke. Tam was keeping them far enough away that the people around the farmhouse were only shapes. Except to Perrin's eyes, he could see children in the yard, and Jack All-Seen was the nearest neighbor. Had been until today. He hesitated, then reined stepper toward the farm. Not that it was likely to do any good, but he had to try. "What are you doing?" Tam asked, frowning. "Giving them the same advice I gave Master All-Seen. It won't take a minute." Tam nodded, and the others turned with him. Varen was studying Perrin thoughtfully. The Aiel peeled away short of the farm to wait to the north, Gaul running a little apart from the maidens. Perrin did not know the Torfinns, nor they him. Yet to his surprise, once the excitement of strangers was past, the staring at Tomas and Varen and Fael, they listened and began hitching horses to two wagons and a pair of high-wheeled carts before he and the others rode on. Three more times he stopped when the route took them near to farmhouses, once at a cluster of five close together. It was always the same. The people protested they could not just leave their farms, but each time he left behind a bustle of packing and a gathering of farm animals. Something else happened, too. He could not stop Will and his cousin, or the Luans, from talking with the young men on the farms. Their party grew by 13, Torfinns and Aldais, Ahans and Marwins, armed with bows and riding an ill-matched assortment of ponies and plow horses, all eager to rescue the prisoners from the White Cloaks. It was not as smooth as that, of course. Will and the others from the All-Seen farm thought it unfair that he warned the newcomers about the Aiel, spoiling the fun they hoped to have seeing them jump. They jumped more than enough to suit Perrin, and the way they peered at every bush, much less every stand of trees, made it clear that they thought there must be more Aiel about, no matter what he said. At first, Will tried lording it over the Torfinns and the rest on the grounds that he had been the first to join Perrin. One of the first, at least, he admitted when Ban and the Luans glared at him, while they were latecomers. Perrin put an end to it by dividing them into two groups of about the same size and putting Danil and Ban each in charge of one, though there was some grumbling over that, too, in the beginning. The Aldais thought the leader should be chosen according to age, Billy Aldais being the eldest by a year, while others put forward Hugh Marwyn as the best tracker and J.M. Torfinn as the best shot, while Kenley Ahan had been to Watch Hill often before the White Cloaks came, and would know his way around the village. They all seemed to think it a lark. Tell's phrase about casting defiance was repeated more than once. Finally, Perrin rounded on them in cold anger, forcing everyone to a halt in the grass between two copses. "This is not a game, and it isn't a Beltane dance. You do what you're told, or else go back home. I don't know what use you are anyway, and I've no intention of getting killed because you think you know what you are doing. Now line up and shut up. You sound like the women's circle meeting in a wardrobe." They did it, stringing themselves out in two columns behind Ban and Danil. Will and Billy wore disgruntled frowns, but they held whatever objections they had. Fael gave Perrin an approving nod, and so did Tomas. Varen watched it all with a smooth, unreadable face, no doubt thinking she was seeing a Taviran at work. Perrin saw no need to tell her. He had just tried to think of what a Shinaran he knew, a soldier named Uno, would have said, though no doubt Uno would have put it in harsher words. Farms began to appear more frequently as they approached Watch Hill, coming in clumps closer together until they ran on continuously, the way they did near Emmons Field, A patchwork of hedged or stone-walled fields separated by narrow lanes, footways, and wagon paths. Even with their pauses at the four farms, there was still some daylight left. Still men working their crops, and boys driving sheep and cattle in from pasture for the night. No one would be leaving their animals out these days. Tam suggested Perrin cease warning people, and he reluctantly agreed. They would all head for Watch Hill here, alerting the White Cloaks. 20-odd people riding together by backways attracted enough eyes, though most people appeared too busy to do more than glance. It would have to be done sooner or later, though, and the sooner the better. So long as people remained in the countryside, needing White Cloak protection, then the White Cloaks had a foothold in the Two Rivers. They might not want to give up. Perrin kept a sharp eye out for any sign of White Cloak patrols, but except for one dust cloud over toward the north road, heading south, he saw none. After a time, Tam suggested they dismount and lead their horses. Afoot, there was less chance of being spotted, and the hedges, and even the low stone walls, shielded them a little. Tam and Abel knew a thicket that gave a good view of the White Cloak camp, a tangle of oak and sour gum and leather leaf that covered three or four hides, little more than a mile south and west of Watch Hill, over an open stretch of ground. They entered from the south, hurrying. Perrin hoped no one had seen them go in, no one to wonder why they did not come out and comment on it. "Stay here," he told Will and the other young men while they were tying their horses to branches. "Keep your bows handy and be ready to run if you hear a shout. But don't move unless you hear me shout. And if anybody makes any noise, I'll pound his head like an anvil. We're here to look, not pull the White Cloaks down on us by tramping around like blind bulls." Fingering their bows nervously, they nodded. Perhaps it was beginning to dawn on them just what they were doing. The Children of the Light might not take kindly to finding Two Rivers folk riding about in an armed bunch.
"Were you ever a soldier?" Fael asked quizzically in a low voice. "Some of my father's guards talk that way."
"I'm a blacksmith," Perrin laughed. "I've just heard soldiers talk. It seems to work, though."
Even Will and Billy were peering about uneasily and hardly daring to move. Creeping from tree to tree, he and Fael followed Tam and Abel to where the Aiel were already crouching near the thicket's north edge. Varen was there, too, and Tomas, of course. The brush made a thin screen of leaves, enough to hide them, but no hindrance to observation. The White Cloak encampment stretched out at the foot of Watch Hill like a village itself. Hundreds of men, some armored, moved among long, straight rows of white tents with lines of horses, five deep, staked out to east and west. Animals being unsaddled and curried indicated patrols finishing their day, while a double column of maybe 100 mounted men, pristine and precise, trailed off toward the Waterwood at a brisk walk, lances all at the same angle. At intervals around the encampment, white-cloaked guards marched up and down, lances shouldered like spears, burnished helmets flashing in the sinking sun. A rumble came to Perrin's ears. Well to the west, 20 horsemen appeared, galloping from the direction of Emmons Field, hurrying toward the tents. From the direction he and the others had come, a few minutes slower and they would have been seen for sure. A horn sounded, and men began moving to the cook fires. Off to one side lay a much smaller camp, its tents set haphazardly. Some sagged against their guy ropes. Whoever stayed there, most were gone now, only a few horses flicking their tails against flies along a short picket rope indicated that anyone was there at all. Not White Cloaks. The Children of the Light were too rigidly tidy for that camp. Between the thicket and the two sets of tents was an expanse of grass and wildflowers. Very likely the local farmers used it for pasture. Not now, however. It was fairly flat ground. White Cloaks galloping like that patrol could cover it in a minute. Abel directed Perrin's attention to the large camp. "You see that tent near the middle, with a man standing watch at either end? Can you make it out?" Perrin nodded. The low sun was slanting sharp shadows eastward, but he could see well enough. "That's where Natty and the girls are.
and the Luhans. I've seen them come out and go in, one at a time and always with a guard, even to the latrines.
We have tried to sneak in at night 3 times, Tam said, but they keep a tight watch over the perimeter of the camp. We barely got away the last time.
It would be like trying to stick your hand into an anthill without being stung. Perrin sat down at the base of a tall leather leaf with his bow across his knees.
I want to think on this a while. Master Althor, will you settle Will and that lot down? See, none of them takes it into his head to run for home. Like as not, they'd ride straight for the north road, not thinking. And we'd have 50 of those white cloaks over here to investigate. If any of them thought to bring food, you could see they get something to eat. If we have to run, we may spend the rest of the night in the saddle.
Abruptly, he realized he was giving orders, but when he tried to apologize, Tam grinned and said,
Perrin, you took charge back at Jack's place. This isn't the first time I've followed a younger man who could see what had to be done.
You're doing good, Perrin, Abel said before the 2 older men slipped back into the trees.
Perplexed, Perrin scratched his beard. He had taken charge. Now that he thought of it, neither Tam nor Abel had really made a decision since leaving the Alcine farm, only offered suggestions and left it to him. Neither had called him lad since then either.
Interesting, Varen said.
She had her small book out. He wished he could have a chance to read what she had written.
You going to caution me about being foolish again? He said.
Instead of answering, she said in a meditative voice,
It will be even more interesting to see what you do next. I cannot say you are shifting the world on its foundations, as Randall Thor is, but the Two Rivers is surely moving. I wonder if you have a clue as to where you are moving it.
I mean to free the Luhans and the Cauthens, he told her angrily. That's all.
Except for the Trollocs. He let his head drop back against the bowl of the leather leaf and closed his eyes.
All I'm doing is what I have to do. The Two Rivers will stay right where it always has.
Of course, Varen said.
He heard her moving away, her and Tomas, slipper and boots alike, soft on ground, strewn with last year's leaves. He opened his eyes. Fail was staring after the pair, and not best pleased.
She will not leave you alone, she muttered.
The plaited crown of heartsblush he had left on his saddle dangled from her hand.
Aes Sedai never do, he told her.
She turned on him with a challenging look.
I suppose you mean to try bringing them out tonight?
It had to be done now, because he had been passing his warning about and folks knew who had told them. Maybe the White Cloaks would not hurt their prisoners. Maybe. He trusted White Cloak Mercy as far as he could throw a horse. He glanced at Gaul, who nodded.
Tam Althor and Abel Cawthon move well for wetlanders, but these White Cloaks are too stiff to see everything that moves in the dark, I think. I think they expect their enemies to come in numbers and where they can be seen.
Chiad turned amused gray eyes on the Aielman.
Do you mean to move like wind, then, stone dog? It will be diverting to see a stone dog try to move lightly. When my spear sister and I have rescued the prisoners, perhaps we will go back for you, if you are too old to find your own way.
Bane touched her arm, and she looked at the flame-haired woman in surprise. After a moment, she flushed slightly under her tan. Both women shifted their eyes to Fail, who was still watching Perrin, her head up and her arms crossed now. He took a long breath. If he told her he did not want her to come, Bane and Chiad almost certainly would not either. They were still making a point of being with her, not him. Maybe Fail was, too. Perhaps he and Gaul could do it alone, but he could not see how to make her stay if she did not want to. Fail being Fail, she would just as likely sneak after them.
You will stay close to me, he said firmly. I want to rescue prisoners, not leave another behind.
Laughing, she dropped down beside him, snuggling her shoulder under his arm.
Staying close to you sounds a fine idea.
She flipped the crown of red flowers onto his head, and Bane chuckled. He rolled his eyes up. He could just see the edge of the thing hanging over his forehead. He must look a fool. He left it there, though. The sun slid down as slowly as a bead in honey. Abel brought some bread and cheese. Over half those would-be heroes had not brought anything to eat after all. And they ate and waited. Night came, lit by a moon already high but obscured by scurrying clouds. Perrin waited. Lights vanished in the White Cloak camp, and in Watch Hill, too, leaving a sprinkling of glowing windows across the otherwise dark mound, and he gathered Tam and Fayil and the Aiel around him. Everyone's face was clear to him. Varen stood close enough to listen. Abel and Tomas were with the other two rivers folk, keeping them quiet. He felt a little odd giving instructions, so kept them simple. Tam was to have everyone ready to ride the moment Perrin returned with the prisoners. The White Cloaks would be after them as soon as they discovered what was up, so a place to hide was needed. Tam knew one, an empty farmhouse in the edge of the Westwood.
"Try not to kill anybody, if you can manage it," Perrin cautioned the Aiel.
"The White Cloaks will be hot enough at losing their prisoners. They'll set the sun afire if they lose men, too." Gaul and the maidens nodded as if they looked forward to it. Strange people. They vanished into the night.
"Have a care," Varen told him softly as he slung his bow across his back. "Tavirin does not mean immortal."
"Tomas might be a help, you know."
"Do you think one more would make a difference?" she said musingly. "Besides, I have other uses for him."
Shaking his head, he moved out from the thicket, going to elbows and knees, almost flat to the ground, as soon as he was beyond the brush. Fayil imitated him at his side. The grass and wildflowers stood high enough to screen them. He was glad she could not see his face. He was desperately afraid. Not for himself, but if anything happened to her. Like two more shifting moon shadows, they crawled across the open ground, stopping at Perrin's signal about 10 paces from where guards paced up and down, cloaks gleaming in the moonlight, a little way out from the first row of tents. Two came face to face almost in front of them, stomping to a halt. "All is well with the night," one announced. "The light illumine us and protect us from the shadow."
"All is well with the night," the other replied. "The light illumine us and protect us from the shadow."
Turning on their heels, they marched away, looking neither left nor right. Perrin let each take a dozen paces, then touched Fayil's shoulder and rose, barely letting himself breathe. He could hardly hear her breathing either. Almost tiptoeing, they hurried in among the tents, dropping low again as soon as they were past the first. Men snored inside or muttered in their sleep. Except for that, the camp was silent. The tramp of the guards' boots was plainly audible. The smell of doused cook fires hung in the air, the scents of canvas and horses and men. Silently, he motioned for Fayil to follow him. Tent ropes made snares for unwary feet in the darkness. They were clear to him, though, and he wove a path through for them. He had the location of the prisoner's tent marked in his head, and he started toward it cautiously. Near the center of the camp. A long way there and a long way back. The crunch of boots on the ground and a grunt from Fayil spun him around just in time to be knocked down by the rush of a big shape in a white cloak, a man as thick as Master Luhan himself. Iron fingers dug into his throat as the two of them rolled. Perrin seized the man's chin with one hand, forcing his head back, trying to push him off. Prying at the grip on his throat, he pounded at the fellow's wrists with his fist, producing grunts and no other effect he could tell. Blood roared in his ears. His vision narrowed, black creeping in from the sides. He fumbled for his axe, but his fingers felt numb. Suddenly the man jerked and collapsed atop him. Perrin pushed the limp form off himself and drew in deep lungfuls of sweet night air. Fayil tossed aside a chunk of firewood and rubbed the side of her head.
"He did not think I was worth worrying about, beyond knocking down," she whispered.
"A fool," Perrin whispered back, "but a strong one."
He was going to have the feel of those fingers at his neck for days.
"Are you all right?"
"Of course. I'm not a porcelain figurine."
He supposed she was not at that. Hastily dragging the unconscious man up against the side of a tent, where he hoped no one would find him soon, he stripped off the fellow's white cloak and bound his hands and feet with spare bowstrings. A kerchief found in the fellow's pocket served for a gag. Not very clean, but that was his own fault. Lifting his bow over his head, Perrin settled the cloak around his shoulders. If anyone else saw them, maybe they would mistake him for one of their own. The cloak had a golden knot of rank beneath the flaring sunburst. An officer, even better. He walked between the tents openly now, and quickly. Hidden or not, that fellow could be found any moment, and the alarm raised. Fail scudded along beside him like his shadow, scanning the camp for signs of life as alertly as he did. Shifting moon shadows obscured the spaces between the tents even for his eyes. Approaching the prison tent, he slowed, so as not to excite the guards. A white-cloaked man stood at this end, and the gleaming lance-point of another rose above the tent's peaked roof. Suddenly, that lance-point vanished. There was no sound, it simply fell. A heartbeat later, two patches of darkness abruptly became veiled Aiel, neither tall enough for Gaul. Before the guard could move, one of them leaped into the air, kicking him in the face. He staggered to his knees, and the other maiden spun, adding her own kick. The guard dropped bonelessly. Crouching, the maidens looked around, spears ready, to see if they had roused anyone. At the sight of Perrin in a white cloak, they nearly went for him, until they saw Fail. One shook her head and whispered to the other, who appeared to laugh silently. Perrin told himself he should not feel disgruntled, but first Fail saved him from being strangled, and now she saved him from a spear through his liver. For somebody who was supposedly leading a rescue, he was making a fine showing so far. Tossing the tent flap aside, he put his head into the interior, which was even darker than outside. Master Luhan lay asleep across the tent's entrance, with the women huddled together toward the back. Perrin put a hand over Harald Luhan's mouth, and, when his eyes popped open, laid a finger across his own lips.
"Wake the others," Perrin said in a low voice. "Quietly. We are taking you out of here."
Recognition dawned in Master Luhan's eyes, and he nodded. Backing out of the tent, Perrin stripped the cloak from the downed guard. The man was still breathing, hoarsely and bubbling through a thoroughly broken nose, but being manhandled did not wake him. They had to hurry now. Gaul was there, with the cloak from the other guard. The three Aiel watched the other tents cautiously. Fail practically danced with impatience. When Master Luhan brought his wife and the other women out, all of them peering about nervously in the moonlight, Perrin hurriedly put one of the cloaks around the blacksmith. It was a poor fit. Harald Luhan seemed to be made from tree trunks, but it had to do. The other went around Alsbet Luhan. She was not so large as her husband, but still as big as most men. Her round face looked surprised at first, but then she nodded. Pulling the fallen guard's conical helmet from his head, she stuck it on her own, squashing it down atop her thick braid. The two guards they bound and gagged with strips of blanket and laid inside the tent. Sneaking out again the way they had come in was impossible. Perrin had known that from the start. Even if Master and Mistress Luhan had moved quietly enough, which he doubted, Bode and Eldrin were clinging to each other in shocked disbelief at rescue. Only their mother's soft murmurs kept them from breaking into relieved tears already. He had planned for it. Horses were needed, both for a quick burst of speed away from the camp and to carry everyone afterward. There were horses at the picket lines. The Aiel ghosting ahead, he followed behind with Fail and the Cawthons behind, Harald and Alsbet bringing up the rear. To a casual glance, at least, they looked like three white cloaks escorting four women. The picketed horses were guarded, but only on the side away from the tents. After all, why guard them from the men who rode them? It certainly made Perrin's job easier. They simply walked up to the line of horses nearest the tents, each secured by a simple rope hackamore, and untied one apiece, except for the Aiel. The hardest part was getting Mistress Luhan up barebacked. It took Perrin and Master Luhan both, and she kept trying to push her skirts down to cover her knees. Natty and her girls scrambled up easily, and Fael, of course. The guards supposedly watching the horses continued their measured rounds, calling to each other about all being well with the night.
"When I give the word," Perrin began,
and someone in the camp shouted, then again more loudly. A horn sounded, and shouting men poured out of the tents. Whether they had found the prisoners gone or the unconscious man who had attacked him, it made no difference.
"Follow me,"
Perrin cried, digging his heels into the dark gelding he had chosen.
"Ride!"
It was a madcap rush, but he tried to keep an eye on everyone. Master Luhan was almost as bad a rider as his wife, the pair of them bouncing around, nearly falling as their horses ran. Either Bode or Eldrin was screaming at the top of her lungs from excitement or terror. Luckily, the guards were not expecting trouble from inside the camp. One white-cloaked man, peering into the darkness, turned just in time to throw himself out of the way of the charging horses with a cry almost as shrill as the Cawthon girls. More horns bayed behind them, and shouts with the definite sound of orders hammered the night, well before they reached the cover of the thicket. Not that it was much cover now. Tam had everyone mounted, as Perrin had asked, or ordered. He swung straight from the gelding to Stepper. Verin and Tomas were the only ones not all but jumping up and down in their saddles. Their horses were the only ones not dancing with their riders' nervousness. Abel was trying to hug his wife and daughters, all three at the same time, all of them laughing and crying. Master Luhan was trying to shake every hand he could reach. Everybody except the Aiel, Verin and her warder, seemed to be offering everybody else congratulations, as though it were all done.
"Why, Perrin, it is you!" Mistress Luhan exclaimed.
Her round face looked peculiar under the helmet, sitting askew because of her braid.
"What is that thing on your face, young man? I am more than grateful to you, but I will not have you at my table looking like a—"
"No time for that,"
he told her, ignoring the shock on her face. She was not a woman people cut off, but the white cloak horns were sounding something besides an alarm now. A short, repetitive cry, sharp and insistent. An order of some kind.
"Tam! Abel! Take Master Luhan and the women to that hiding place you know. Gaul, you go with them. And Fael."
That would add Bane and Chiat.
"And Hugh and Hayim."
That should be enough to be safe.
"Move quietly. Quiet is better than speed. For a little while, anyway. But go now."
Those he named wound off westward with no argument, though Mistress Luhan, holding her horse's mane with both hands, gave him a very level look. It was the lack of argument from Fael that stunned him, enough that it took him a moment to realize he had called Master Althor and Master Cawthon by their first names. Verin and Tomas had stayed behind, and he eyed her sharply.
"Any chance of a little help from you?"
"Not the way you mean, perhaps," she replied calmly, as though the White Cloak camp were not in turmoil just a mile off. "My reasons are no different today than yesterday, but I think it might rain in, half an hour, maybe less. Quite a downpour, I expect."
"Half an hour." Perrin grunted and turned to the remaining two rivers lads. Practically quivering with the desire to run, they held their bows in white-knuckled grips. He hoped they had all remembered to bring spare bowstrings, at least, since it was going to rain.
"We," he told them, "are going to draw the white cloaks off so Mistress Cawthon and Mistress Luhan and the rest can get away safely. We'll take them south along the north road until we can lose them in the rain. If anyone wants out, he had best ride now."
A few hands shifted on their reins, but they all sat their saddles looking at him.
"All right, then. Shout like you've gone mad so they'll hear us. Shout until we reach the road."
Bellowing, he wheeled Stepper and galloped for the road. At first, he was not really certain they would follow, but their wild howls drowned his roar and the thunder of their hooves. If the White Cloaks did not hear that, they were deaf. Not all of them stopped shouting when they reached the hard-packed dirt of the north road and swung south at a dead run through the night. Some laughed and whooped. Perrin shrugged out of the white cloak and let it fall. The horns sounded again, a little fainter now.
"Perrin!" Will called, leaning forward on the neck of his horse. "What do we do now? What do we do next?"
"We hunt Trollocs,"
Perrin shouted over his shoulder. From the way the laughter redoubled, he did not think they believed him. But he could feel Varen's eyes drilling into his back. She knew. Thunder in the night sky echoed the horse's hooves.